So-called preventive blindness. Eric, don't forget.
Med Family is a show about a family journeying through medical school with kids and navigating married life. Tag along to see how we got here and where this journey is taking us. Hello, welcome to another week of our, another episode of our podcast, Med Family. I'm Eric Acker, the host, with my lovely wife, Karen.
Hey, guys.
So we've been out for a little bit dealing with regular life residency stuff and
Had Eric's parents visit. We had a car problem, another oral surgery appointment for a different kiddo, some teeth extracted there,
and all of our kids are getting oral surgery.
And then we had the dishwasher break, so we've had a few things that we've had to fix and work schedules around. So we apologize that we didn't get anything out this last week.
The last couple weeks.
But, you know, life happens.
Yeah, so we had a pretty cool radiology rotation, which was pretty nice, very relaxed. And going in, you know, around, 8:30, 9 o'clock. And looking at x-ray films, looking at swallow studies, and reviewing how to do those, how to look at studies and imaging studies from the attending. And then we, again, would skip off and do swallow studies. And then we would look at occasional ultrasounds. And then we were done by, like, noon. So, and provided if we didn't have any didactics that day, we were basically done for the day. And that was a pretty wonderful couple weeks. There's definitely a part of me. There's a lot of residents who have this rotation for like 4 weeks, and definitely a large part of me that was very jealous of that and was hoping I would be on 4 weeks of radiology, but it is what it is. I had done, I think, 1 week of 3 South and 1 week of 8 South the weeks prior, so it was nice to have a small little breather before starting clinic. We did clinic this last week, and that... I don't know. I don't really love clinic, and I'm trying to get my mindset, because I think there is this mentality that clinic sucks, outpatient clinic sucks, and in a lot of ways our continuity clinic is less than fun. And then with that, all that kind of there, you get this kind of environment or culture where it's kind of like in med school where everyone liked to complain about the administration, the school, and how things were done. And I mean, I think a lot of people in medical schools everyone has a complaint, usually pretty valid, I would say, but maybe overblown in many cases. And so I think this you build this culture where it becomes fun to complain, but then, well, since I kind of deal with a little bit of stress and anxiety with this whole year and trying to be a good resident, trying to be a good doctor, and not wanting to hurt anybody, oftentimes I feel like, oh gosh, you get into the surrounding of everyone is complaining, everyone is saying this is going to be a bad week and clinic is terrible, and you kind of get caught up in that and you just kind of dread clinic. And even though realistically our clinic is scheduled a half a day of clinic, a half a day of learning. So you either do procedures, you do ultrasound, you do sim lab, professional development, research, all those sort of things happen on your half day. So it seems silly to be feeling like, oh, this is going to be awful. You work half a day for a whole week. Like that's, I still, I think, put in about 35, 38 hours of work last week, regardless, because I did some hot seat time and then some of our procedures. Actually, we actually did procedures this week, whereas previous weeks the sim lab was down, so we didn't do a whole lot of procedures. In any case.
However, I will say, Eric, the first half of the year, Eric worked mornings, and so on Thursdays, he'd work the morning clinic, and then he'd have didactics in the afternoon. Didactics does not change. So when he works afternoons, he goes to didactics, and then he works at a care clinic.
Yeah,
it's not the continuity clinic, and that I think Eric finds a little bit more enjoyment in, and I think it's just the differences in acuity of patient.
Go ahead. You're good.
Oh, I was just saying, in the continuity clinic, it seems like they get a lot of patients that have a lot of major problems, that most of those problems are going to have to be referred out to some sort of specialist. And so you're trying to figure out what you can do. And sorry, we've got a kid.
He poked his head into the room and just stared at us first, like, while doing the head motion, like, get out of here.
We're trying to do this while they're still awake. sorry, that made me lose my train of thought.
Family life, sorry.
Continuity clinic, you're just trying to figure out, like, what can you help these people with and how to get them to their next specialty visit.
Specialist, yeah.
And then on top of that, a lot of them are non-compliant. So sometimes I think it feels like you are doing your job, but at the same time, it's not making a difference. And I think that makes it harder than the care clinic, where you're helping people who really need it and you're helping them with a specific problem and then they go on their way.
Yeah, it could be like two or three problems. Like one of the patients I saw during care clinic had like three things, and it was very easy-ish. I mean, care clinic tends to screen their patients a little bit more because it is a free clinic. They know that they don't have ample resources to do everything, and so they tend to not have train wrecks, quote-unquote train wrecks. And anyone in the medical community kind of knows what a train wreck is. Whereas a continuity clinic, it's kind of whoever shows up that day and whoever's scheduled and decides to show up that day. That's the other issue. There's a lot of no-shows, which honestly, for better or worse, I don't hate. But there's always a lot of stress with the care clinic because you try to like knock out the top three things they come into. And sometimes it's just like a jumble of things and not very descript. And you're trying to figure out like, what can I actually do for this patient? And sometimes it's very straightforward and it's just like, oh, you have this complaint. Let's work it up. And so I do appreciate that. And I guess what I was trying to get to is that there's a culture around clinic that is very negative. And I don't think I particularly like clinic. I think I've said that plenty of times before, where I don't like clinic. I understand if I go into cardiology, it's a good chance I will have clinic, but it'll be very directed. Like, I didn't hate ortho clinic when I was doing my ortho rotation because it was pretty straightforward. People came in with a problem, you diagnosed it, and you moved on. You offered some treatments, and you kind of proceeded from there. But continuity clinic is difficult and different because you have this, you can need continuity, but really it doesn't feel like a lot of continuity because sometimes you'll see that patient and they come back, they see somebody completely different and so on. So it can be very difficult in that regard. Anyway, my whole point is I've been trying this week to break out of that culture of negativity because I found myself talking like the other people on like day one, Monday, complaining about continuity clinic, how awful it was. And I was finding that all it did was make me dread going to work more, made me not want to work. It made me have anxiety. It made me, it just did not make the outlook of the week really good. And I was like, this is Monday and I'm already feeling terrible. And I had to get through four more days of work. And this is clinic. This is a half day. I'm supposed to be able to like take a breath. And because I know after this week, I still have a couple shorter things, rotations. Like, so I will go into cardiology for the next 2 weeks. And I've heard that that's a little bit more medium to strenuous. It's not like being on East South, but it's also not like being on radiology. So we're going to be working a little bit more on cardiology. And then I do 2 weeks of nights, which I tend to loathe nights, but I'm hoping that it looks like there's a bunch of seniors on nights with me. So I'm hoping that that goes pretty well. And it's just 2 weeks and I'm done. And then I have a week off That's supposed to be clinic week, but I took the week off, so we get to do doctor's appointments. So, yay.
we're trying to get those all booked at the beginning of the week so that we can have a fun time at the end of the week. But
and Karen's trying to give me these silver linings, and I really do appreciate it. Like the nights, I do 4 days on and 1 day off, and then 7 days on. So I will.
Which really does suck, but at the same time, the days off, he doesn't really, I mean, you can't switch your sleep schedule in 1 day.
Yeah, you might as well not have a day off. Yeah. And so the beauty of it is I think how it works out, you do Monday through Thursday, Friday off, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. So you did do another 7, and then I'm off Saturday and Sunday.
And then he has the whole
week then I off. Have the whole week off, so which it's like
9 days.
I get basically Saturday and Sunday to get myself back on a normal schedule of sleep. I'll feel awful probably Saturday, Sunday, Monday, and then hopefully we can do some fun things as a family. Just enjoy being off, not having to think about work, do work, or anything like that. That sounds wonderful. and then I do 2 weeks of floors. I have 3 weeks of floors left, so I'll do 2 weeks, and then I'll do like a week and a half of infectious disease, which is, again, not a very strenuous rotation. I say a week and a half because I still have some 3 days of PTO, and that's my last chance to use it, so I'm going to try to use it. And then I go back to clinic, and then I do ICU, and then I go back to clinic. And then I have 1 week of floors, and then that's the end of the academic year. So I don't know what my next academic year will pick up as. But yeah. We have, you know, critical care, ICU. We have 3 weeks of floors left. We have 2 weeks of nights. So we have still a pretty good schedule going on between here and the end of the year. So I can't be looking at clinic week and dreading it, especially when, you know, between, you know, floors and critical care, what's going to stop me from being burned out? Well, it's going to be clinic week. I'm going to have to hopefully sit back and enjoy clinic week for what it is, even if it is frustrating to have some clinical patients that are difficult and tricky. Like my last day, I think Friday, I just had so many patients. I thought I was coasting a little bit on Friday. I saw my first patient and he was a little late, but you know, it seemed like he was bad on paper, good on exam, which is always nice. And then they had my next appointment was supposed to be another hour later, but they ended up putting another patient in earlier. So I just immediately started running behind. And that was very stressful, feeling like you're running behind. And it was like nondescript issues, unclear expectations, and having to tell a patient, no, I'm not going to prescribe opiates for chronic pain, and then kind of go from there. And then you have a concerning symptom for the next patient, and we need to really work this up. And the last one was pretty straightforward, relatively straightforward. But like, I was the last one out of clinic that on Friday night, which kind of stunk. But you know, it is what it is. Again, mentality. Finding, I guess, my advice is that finding the rotations that people are going to complain about, especially again, if you can just power through it and whatever, you know, you can shrug it off, then good on you. I am struggling with anxiety. I am struggling with dreading going into work sometimes, a lot of self-doubt, a lot of frustration there, even though most of my feedback has been pretty positive. So I need to get out of my head a lot. And Karen's been trying to help me with that. It's going to be a process. But if you're anything like me, when you find these rotations that everyone is complaining about and it's popular and fun to joke about, but the after effect is you feel worse going through it, maybe try to find a way to change your attitude towards it. Because again, like, I don't have to like clinic, but I don't have to dread it either. I can see it for what it is. It's, you know, a week of half days where I see anything between 2 to 6 patients a day. And, you know, if I get no shows, then great. And being in the afternoon, we have care clinic. So really it's only 4 days of clinic. And care clinic is pretty straightforward. Like, okay, that first day of care clinic, I think I saw two, maybe three patients. I think it was three. And this last one, I saw one. So, you know, it is what it is.
And they feed you.
And they feed you. Granted, I missed out on food this time, but that's okay. Lesson learned.
They feed you and you get a cup.
Yeah, you can get a glass. You can get like a water bottle. They have other things. I pick up the glasses because they seem, we don't really have a lot of glasses. So yeah,
somehow they didn't make the move.
There's another resident in my PGY 1 year, and he's doing the same thing. Like every time he goes to care clinic, he gets a cup, and he's kind of stocking his kitchen with care clinic swag. So it is what it is. I don't have a whole lot of advice. I guess anything else you wanted to touch on before I do want the one or two teaching points, I guess?
I don't know if we've kind of implemented a few things, and we've touched on this before, where Eric is going to try and do a daddy kid date once a month. We're going to try and do an at-home date once a month or once a quarter. But I don't know if we've actually decided on that one. Eric and I are trying to listen to the Bible in a year, kind of get our head on straight a little bit and refocus.
I will say I'm, as much as it's kind of a slog,
we're in the Old Testament right now.
With the Bible in a year, and like you, if you know the Bible and how it's oriented, like okay, Genesis is Genesis, and then you get into like Deuteronomy, Leviticus, and you're just like, oh my gosh, Numbers, and you're just like, okay, let's keep going. It can be a bit of a slog, especially in the beginning. So, I'm so proud of myself. I think I'm on like. Today might be the only day I've actually missed, so I might have to try to keep my... I've been good at listening to... It's only like 20, 25 minutes a day.
Yeah.
And so I've been good at listening to it every day for the last 69, 70 days. So I'm doing good so far.
He's doing better than I am. I have missed days.
I also have a drive to work where I just listen to it. And so I have 20 minutes dedicated time plus whatever it takes me to walk into the hospital, whereas you have kids climbing all over you and screaming and yelling and whining and fighting, so it's hard. And just like right now, we have one kid who decides he just does not want to go to sleep. He is dedicated to his goldfishes, even though we are fresh out of goldfishes. Sorry, you were saying. I didn't mean to.
So, yeah, a Bible in a year. And then I think we were talking this week and along the lines of not complaining. I think we were thinking maybe we need to find like one to three things each day that were positives and just kind of go over them at night just to like end the day on a positive note and hopefully start the day on a positive note. Because it's very easy to focus on what's hard and what's negative. And if we start to train our brains to think on the positive, I'm hoping that it will help both of us. But that is another thing that we are going to implement.
Yeah, it's mental health, right? trying to throw off the shackles of PGY 1 year and frustrations and realizing that in 3 months, I'm going to have interns that are going to be going through everything I just went through, and I'll be responsible for looking out for them and doing, you know, making sure that they do their job. And it's going to be good times. yeah, it's going to be interesting for sure. 100%. And which I guess brings me up to the notion that Monday, I believe is the day that I'm not sure when this podcast is actually going to be published, maybe tonight. but Monday is the match. These people get the notifications that they have matched or not matched. And so the ones who don't go through the SOAP process, which sounds awful. And I hope for the best for everyone who has to go through that process. And all those people who are waiting with bated breath tonight, because tonight's Sunday, so it's small, with the possibility of residency. It's kind of, it's wild to think about. And I, this is going to be like kind of a Debbie Downer sort of thing. So bear with me. Like a year ago, I am anxious for whether or not I'm going to start residency, whether I'm going to match and go to a place I want to go to. And, you know, I have my rank order list in mind. And so we've already been making plans of how life is going to be in our top three spots and where we're going to live. And, you know, you're just waiting to hear. Obviously, Monday, you don't know where, but you know that you matched. And it's kind of crazy to think that, like, that was a year ago, and today, just like, oh my gosh, I have to do this for two more years at least. It's like, I can't believe I was excited to do this. I can't believe I was just like, oh, I can't wait to be matched and go to a residency and be a practicing doctor. And it's like, I feel exhausted. I feel beaten. And I guess that's like a very kind of negative approach. I know a lot of people feel burnout, especially, and it's amazing. So we had this meeting during didactics, at the end of didactics. Some of our chiefs took aside each year. So PGY 1, 2, and 3 went to different locations. And they just were talking to people. What are your thoughts about your seniors? What are your thoughts about the attendings? Anyone feeling burned out? And, like, of course, like, this is my clinic week. I've had radiology a couple weeks before. So, like, this is actually not bad. I can't be very distraught. Obviously, it's very frustrating to be anxious and having self-doubts. But, like, I'm not totally burned out right now. But I knew other people were feeling more burned out, but nobody, absolutely nobody spoke up. And I thought that was kind of interesting, that mentality that we will fake it till we make it. We won't complain. You know, we will complain, but nobody wants to let on that they are being burned out, that they are struggling to get through each week, and that some of the work is kind of soul crushing. Not necessarily, I mean, that sounds awful, but like there's a lot of social level stuff and things and family related things that just can be very frustrating, especially when you're on inpatient wards. And then you feel very alone.
Also sad. I think that's the thing. Like, it's sad to view other families that are just so dysfunctional.
Yeah, and there's nothing you can do about it. It's not what you went to medical school for. Everyone, I think, pictures this, like, I'm going to go to the hospital. I'm going to take care of patients. I'm going to get them feeling better. I'm going to send them home. They're going to go live the rest of their life and, you know, be happy. But, like, really, a lot of the people you come in contact with, especially on resident services, are very sick. And there's a good number of them who are going to go on to comfort care and hospice, and they're going to pass. There's a good number of them who this is not their first time in the hospital, and certainly not going to be the last. And they are in and out of the hospital, or they've had multiple strokes, and you're just dealing with dementia. You're dealing with people bouncing back and forth from care facilities, or they are at psych facilities that, you know, they have psychiatric issues, but they are at a care facility, and then, like, they have altered mental status, and, like, you're just, like, banging your head on a wall going, I don't know how to help. I don't know how I'm helping in any of these situations. And it's very frustrating. That means we don't care any less, but it's one extra layer that you don't really learn in medical school, that, like, sometimes you do your best and you practice the best medicine that you know. And there's a different element, the social element, that is just going to be hard. Because what do you do when you say, I got nothing else medically to do with this patient, but I can't send them home because they don't have a good environment to go home to? And, or I'm going to send them home, but they don't have a home to go to. Like, they don't have any home. Like, you discharge to the street. Now you got to think about how that's going to work. Because obviously, if you're like, oh, if they just need to take, you know, just set them up a PIC line, and they can just get, you know, the antibiotics, you know, every couple of days, then that should be fine. But, like, well, if they're going to the street, you can't do that. You definitely should not discharge anyone to the street with a PIC line, much for multiple reasons. Obviously, one reason is you don't want that PIC line to get infected, but also it's used for street drugs. And we don't need to make that a thing. Anywho, Anyway, it's very difficult. It's very frustrating to go through all this, and something you don't really learn in medical school, and you're kind of figuring it out. And maybe that's not. Maybe that was just our medical school. And also, resident services tend to have the worst, like the ones with underinsured or non-insured or whatever it is. They tend to end up on the resident services, and it can be very difficult because you're just like, why are we getting bad patients at the bad patient? The bad patients are themselves not bad, but just like complicated discharges, complicated illnesses. Anywho, I'm dragging this out. My whole point was that during this didactics, I knew a few people who were struggling and nobody would speak up. And that was interesting. It's interesting that basically all your fellow residents are going through the same thing, and they'll complain about certain things, and that can be very difficult, but they don't speak up. Nobody wants to feel like they're weak. Nobody wants to let on with their peers or their superiors that I'm struggling with this or this or this. So that was interesting. But I did reach out to other medical student residents who have matched with me last year, people I know. And they will, like, some are PGY2s now, and some are PGY1s like me. And they're all like, we're intern. Like, the PGY1s are like, yeah, I 100% feel that. When I was coming off of this rotation, it was horrible. I was feeling burned out and I was struggling. But like, we're PGY1s. We're here to learn, and we're not here to get it 100% right. We're doing our best. You know, you keep working at it, and eventually you're going to get it. You're going to get there. But you're a PGY1, so give yourself some slack. You are going to be a PGY2, and you're eventually going to be a 3, and then you're going to be doing whatever you do after that, whether that's fellowship or independent practice or whatever. But like, in your intern year, you are an intern. You are not a PGY3. So don't feel like you're completely inadequate. And I'm saying that as I feel inadequate. So there's that. But it was nice to hear that other residents and other people in my position, you know, are also struggling with the same stuff, and they are working on it and offering some words of encouragement and whatnot. So I'm hopeful with regards to all of that. The other thing I guess I noticed this last week was we had some people over, a resident over, and their spouse, and we were talking shop, and I didn't realize how much that really made me feel like I was dreading going back to work. Like, just like they were on floors and they were talking about what was going on floors, and, you know, certain patients that we were all familiar with, and not necessarily naming them by name, obviously, because not everyone is, you know, involved in the treatment of these patients. But like, we were going over how things were going, and it was just like, man, that sounds awful. That sounds terrible. And then my brain goes, well, that's going to be me on nights in 2 weeks or 3 weeks. You know, I'm going to be there in 3 weeks. I'm going to be cardiology consulting in a couple days. And so it's like, oh my gosh, I don't want to do it. So it was kind of interesting. You got to remind yourself to try to have a life outside of work. And it's difficult because not in residency, not a lot of people really understand what you go through. And the ones that do are either your spouse or residents. And so a lot of your social circle incorporates medical staff of some kind because they kind of relate to you. But then all you do is talk about work, and then you don't feel like you've disconnected or you turned off work for a minute to take a breath. So I don't know, something to think about if you're getting into medicine is to try to find a way to detach from medicine. Even you can't do it completely. I don't think that's possible, but even for a few hours or a day or so here and there, because obviously residency is about learning and trying to get better. And so that does mean you have to continue to study and read as much as you can. And then doing things, and residency is long hours, a lot of work. So you can't really turn that off 100% of the time, but finding some time to turn it off. And I don't know, that's my pointer there. I don't know, that's my little rant. I've been trying to do this quick teaching thing of what I've learned this week. And so I do listen to the This Week in Cardiology, and I also listen to EM Crit podcast. And then occasionally I'll listen to other things. I'll re-listen to a Palm Crit podcast or the Internet Book of Critical Care. But one of the things that kind of caught my eye this week, So one was a study out, it was a multi-study. It was published in a European journal, but I saw it on Twitter, of all places. One of the people who, I think Josh Farkas, who's the Internet Book of Critical Care, he's one of the authors of that. He has linked to it on one of his social medias, and it's just basically this study of a multi-center study looking at occlusion myocardial infarctions and the 12-lead ECG, and then using machine learning AI. And they were basically, I can't remember the numbers off the top of my head, but they were significantly improved using AI of finding and identifying occlusion myocardial infarctions. And I'm using OMI, which is the occlusion myocardial infarction, because traditionally we've thought of it as STEMI and NSTEMI, ST elevation, non-ST elevation myocardial infarctions. But I think the system is trying to move towards this occlusion, obstructive myocardial infarction language, because sometimes the ECG isn't very obvious. Like sometimes we see some very slight changes here and there, and obviously the read of the ECG is at the mercy of the person reading it, and of course how it was placed on the patients. And so the machine learning AI in this study showed that it was actually able to identify more occlusion myocardial infarctions faster than the human could. And so oftentimes, like, you'd see someone with crushing chest pain, maybe like a TIMI score of 3 or 4, whatever it is, and maybe this is an NSTEMI, maybe it's not. So we'll put them on heparin and nitro, and we'll just kind of watch them, serial ECGs, oxygen, nitroglycerin, you know, and then after a few days go, okay, cardiologist is going to go ahead and cath the patient. And by that point, it's like 2-3 days later, they cath, and like, oh my gosh, we had one on the floor that, you know, was kind of similar, in and out of the hospital for chest pain, even saw the cardiologist and thought to be probably some kind of gastric reflux. Finally comes in, his troponins are slightly elevated, but not like remarkably so. His EKG isn't crazy, but it's kind of different. He spent like a weekend with us, and finally gets his calf and finds it like 90% occlusion of the LAD. So it's like, oh, that's significant. He was definitely having an ischemic event. He's not infarcted, but it's definitely an ischemic event. So there's a thought that if you can get to these quicker, then maybe you can reverse any possible damage to the myocardium. And the longer the myocardium is ischemic, then the more damage possibly that could be done. So reversing it could possibly provide better oxygenation to the myocardium and lessen any myocardial disease that will result from the NSTEMI. So in any case, this AI seemed to have some pretty promising results. So that was something that I was like, oh, that's interesting. I wonder, you know, of all the things AI, where we get concerned about, is AI going to replace doctors? Is AI going to replace radiologists? Is AI going to replace screenwriters, etc.? This is actually an application of AI that might actually prove to be very beneficial, because not every doctor is very good at reading EKGs. We can read the scary stuff, and most doctors are able to read the scary stuff, the ST elevations, the Brugada syndromes possibly, but like, or the AFib. Like, we can read some of the bread and butter stuff, but like some of the more nuanced stuff, we're not always the best at. So AI might be our friend. So that was an interesting study.
Especially if people are coming in to the ED, like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which I would think that most people with chest pain are going to come into the ED. They're not going to come to a cardiologist right away. So it's not the person that's trained to necessarily read those that is reading them all the time.
Yeah, and to be fair, ER doctors are trained to read, but like they're seeing a lot of patients, so they're screening out the scary stuff. And while that like an NSTEMI that is an occlusion myocardial infarction, no, that is still pretty scary. We're just not catching it faster. It could take like 72 hours for us to catch, you know, and get them to the cath lab. Whereas like if you came in with ST elevation, you're in the cath lab within 90 minutes. So, you know, if we could move those NSTEMIs into the other category and get them in faster to the cath lab, maybe we can improve some outcomes. I don't know. We'll see. You know, that's all stuff to be determined and looked at a little bit closer. But that was something I thought was interesting. I think the program I was looking at, because I was interested in possibly doing a more, the study that they had was a retrospective. They looked at EKGs of like 5,000 or so individuals, and they timed how long it took for them to, you know, what they were initially read as, and then what their treatment course was, and then, you know, how long it took for them to get actually into the cath lab. And they had the computer, the AI, read the EKGs, and then they were able to kind of extrapolate that basically their AI was better at catching these OMIs than the human was. And, you know, so there was a big of a discrepancy. They could catch it on like the first EKG instead of like the fourth one, because we do like typically you would do serial ECGs on patients with chest pain. You're suspicious for NSTEMI. So that was one study. I think the other one was, I think, also interesting. I can't remember. It came from the This Week in Cardiology. I don't want to butcher it too badly, but essentially it was a study talking about microplastics or nanoplastics and its possible effects on our cardiac dysfunction or cardiac problems in the future. They basically used the carotid endarterectomies on asymptomatic patients. They sent the plaques that they removed from the carotid arteries to like a mass spectrometer, and they looked for plastics. And of the ones that they had detected plastics, they followed them for multiple years. They followed all of them, I think, for multiple years. And then they reported cardiac events. And so it was interesting in that regard that they were showing that, oh, there was like a hazard ratio. I think it was like 4.5 is what they were saying. So a very significant hazard ratio of having microplastics and exposure to microplastics in their vasculature that led to cardiac events. I thought it was an interesting study how it was presented. The article itself basically was saying, oh, we need to get rid of carbon products, we need to get rid of petrol stuff because of this, where you get your microplastics and whatnot. But the This Week in Cardiology, he was making a point that, well, if you dig a little bit deeper into the study, while it was statistically significant results, some of the things within the study were kind of head scratchers, like elevated LDLs weren't also, they had like a hazard ratio that was actually protective. They had a protective value for cardiac events. And then history of previous cardiac events only had like a hazard ratio of like 1.9 or something like that. So like, how is plastics more hazardous than previous cardiac history? So there was some, and then it was like 10 to 2, like 10 people, and there was 10 events. There wasn't a whole lot of events really within the study. So, and the study was limited to like Italians, I think, if I remember where. So it was an interesting study in that like sometimes clinical statistical significance is interesting and is worth exploring and worth looking into more closely, but maybe not drawing vast conclusions from, especially when it, certain interior portions of it don't really jive with what we already kind of know in medicine, you know, LDL and cardiac, cardiovascular history and that sort of stuff. Yeah. So anyway, so those are kind of some studies that we was looking at. It's like, it's interesting. They were talking about the mint trial, but I need to spend some more time looking at it. And that's basically what hemoglobin level you should keep a patient who has had a myocardial infarction. And I believe the study, I don't want to butcher it too bad, but there was a liberal arm that basically was like, keep the hemoglobin above 10, I think, 10, 12. And then the other conservative arm was like above 7. So normal range is usually like around 12. So obviously the people who were in the liberal arm were getting like multiple transfusions to try to keep the hemoglobin up higher. And that's, they were kind of going over the editorials on that essentially there was no difference, or there was very few differences between the two arms. And I think there was some commenting about, they do this analysis on some studies of like, what would have had to change to make certain things significant or insignificant. So sometimes it's kind of interesting, like you'll have this trial and they'll have like maybe 10 events, and then it's statistically significant. But it's like, well, if you had 9 events, it would not have been significant. Or like if you had 11, you know, whatever it is, like you can change like the significance by just one person within that study having something happen. And so it's kind of always interesting to look at, like, you know, then you have to ask the question, is this just background noise that we're picking up, or is this an actual thing? So in any case, that
one
was
one more thing to
yes
on,
go for it,
because I think let's loop it back to radiology, because it was when it was after Eric had finished the rotation, but the radiologist had sent x-ray. And was like, this is why you need to remember to basically look at the whole x-ray and not just what you were looking for. What was his statement? I can't remember.
Yeah, essentially this person had an abdominal x-ray done, and you look at the abdomen, you know, maybe you're looking for bowel gas consistent of small bowel obstruction, or you're looking for basically obstructive or any sort of pathology within the abdomen. But inevitably, sometimes with these abdominal studies, you're going to get extra bones. You're going to get the ribs. You're going to get pelvis. You're going to get, you know, obviously you're going to get the spine. So his whole lesson was, you need to look at everything. Like, obviously, they are asking you to look at the abdomen, so you're going to comment on the abdomen 100%. But since you have this opportunity to review other stuff, you should review everything within the view. And so in this particular abdominal x-ray, there were broken ribs in like the
several,
like you couldn't see above, I think, the 10th rib. So you basically had 10, 11, 12, and like 12 is small, 11 is pretty small. So you can really see the 10th rib was fractured on one side. And I think on the other side, you can see like the 9th or 10th rib, and that was also fractured. But because it was like the top of the x-ray and it was an abdominal x-ray, I think it was implied that it was missed. Because, well, the bowel gas pattern is showing a non-obstructive pattern. So there we go, move on. And the lesson there was, well, this person came back about a month later, and the x-ray shows clubbing of the ribs. Like, it was basically from, like, the first rib all the way to, like, the 10th. And you can see this clubbing, which is usually like a couple weeks into healing process. So this person had like ribs broken all on one side, all on the other side. They had, you can see this skim lines over the humerus head, which kind of indicates, not humerus head, the proximal humerus, not the humeral head, because the humeral head on this individual hadn't really been ossified. And the skim lines kind of tell you, hey, there was a break here. This is bone healing action. And there was, you know, wavy gray lines on the x-ray, which usually, again, indicates some kind of underlying inflammatory trauma to the underlying tissues. So this person had been, like, very much abused. And a month later, you know, and then there's obviously some head trauma going on here too. You have rib fractures, you got hip fractures, shoulder, you know, arm fractures. So this person has had a rough go of it the last month. And, you know, if we maybe would have noticed that hip rib fracture a week before, maybe outcomes could have been different. Who knows? We don't have a crystal ball. We can't read the future, but like that was a lesson. It was just like, look at everything within the view you should look at. Don't just look for what you're looking for. Like, look for everything. So
on that happy note, we wish those who are learning match this week the best. And
let us know. We'll try to keep it. We have people we keep in kind of regular contact with. But if you are following the show and we don't generally contact you very often, just let us know how that's going. Let us know what happens. We're happy to, as much as I'm having a rough go of it, I know it's an exciting time. Like, this is what you worked for in medical school. You're finally getting to the pinnacle of your medical education. Now you're going to get into residency. That's where you really, like, you put everything you learned into practice. And I sincerely hope you guys find great places to go to and, you know, great programs and specialties that you're going to love and will be the jumping off point to your careers. Everything I keep getting told is like residency is tough, but after residency, life is better. And so that's what I'm hoping, that no one's lying to me at this point.
Well, even the second years that we've talked to that are not necessarily in this program have said that second year is a different level of responsibility, but it is better.
Yeah. So I, if you're following the show, I know we don't have a great big following, and my inconsistency in episode publishing is my own big deal. But please let us know if you matched, where you matched. We'd love to kind of celebrate with you and, you know, hear about it. And I still think it's a great profession. Obviously, we've all sacrificed a lot to get to this point. So I want to see a lot of that pay off for you guys. So let us know. We are praying for everyone who's going through the process. We hope that everyone gets a spot that they're looking for. And, you know, everything is within the right God's plan, and you guys are headed in the right direction. So we will continue to try to keep these updates going, and we will talk again next week.